strangers to shame, which makes you think, I wish it was me. I want it to be me. I wish I were dead. In addition to this, you might very well be convinced that it's all my fault, and you have not had the debriefing that will help you fill in the gaps and divide your pain. You are at one of the lowest points in your life. Something horrible has happened in your life, but for your family, something wonderful has happened. You walked in the door. What words might they say to you? Thank God it wasn't you. Though they say this with heartfelt love, you might find it hard to accept, especially in light of your confused thoughts. Many returning veterans of combat also deal with similar survivor guilt. When they hear these words from their families, it can cause them to distance themselves from their loved ones at a time when they need them the most. Right now, while you are calm and rational, you need to understand and accept the fact that your loved ones might say this. As always, prior preparation is the key. Should it happen to you, you will recognize it and say, Grossman warned me that this might happen. It's okay. I can say it to them, and they can say it to me. It is important that you mentally prepare for it, because their words and their love can be hard to accept when you do not like yourself at that moment. It is important to understand that in your world, something horrible happened, but in theirs, something wonderful happened. You walked in the door. There is one other response you might get from your loved ones, anger. Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, author of 9 books dealing with the natural phenomenon of dying, says that there is a set of response stages to death: denial, anger, bargaining, and acceptance. You might walk in the door after your horrible day and run smack into an angry spouse. Someone tried to kill their loved one, and they feel helpless and frustrated that there is nothing they can do. At first, they denied what happened, but then they feel anger. It is important, therefore, that right now, while you are calm and rational, you ask yourself, who are they really angry at? Are they angry at you? No. They are angry at the world that tried to harm their loved one. And in their confusion, they might displace that anger onto you. Once again, can you see how this might distance you from your loved ones when you need them the most? You are a warrior. We talked before about surviving gunshot wounds. If you can take a bullet and drive on, you can certainly take a little displaced anger and drive on. Do not let your loved one's confusion and misplaced anger distance you from them at a time when you need them the most. Hug them, hold them, and cherish them. Wait for their emotions to pass, and know that they will still be there when you need them. And you will be there for them in the years to come, because your warrior spirit prepared you to survive this challenge. Always hug and kiss your loved ones goodbye. Every day when you leave your loved ones to go to work, or when you go on a trip, whether to a combat zone or on business, never forget to kiss that special person in your life and say, I love you, even if you have been fighting. As a warrior, you know that every day is a gift. If you should fall today, you do not want to leave your loved ones with guilt or anger, thinking, he didn't even kiss me goodbye or tell me that he loved me. Upon reading the first edition of On Combat, a police officer sent me his thoughts on this important subject. I would like to add a suggestion to warriors who walk the razor's edge every day. Before a warrior leaves on a mission, whether it's an 8-hour shift as a police officer or a year-long deployment in the military, he or she should go to their family and give them a heartfelt hug coupled with the words, I love you. My wife and I are both police officers. She understands that even when we are arguing and one of us is leaving for work, we follow this ritual. It strengthens us and lets us know that when we are out there, we have something to come home to. And when the warrior comes home, he should kiss his significant other again and tell them that he is glad to see them. In his book, Anatomy of a Riot, my co-author, Lauren Christensen, writes this about a Southern Ohio corrections officer. On April 11th, Easter Sunday of 1993, Peggy Vallandigham kissed her husband Robert goodbye in the kitchen as he left for work at the Southern Ohio Correction Facility, where for the past 2 years he worked as a corrections officer. Robert walked out into the garage, then he paused. He turned, ran back inside his house to do something he had never done before. He kissed his wife goodbye a second time. She would never see him alive again. Within hours, he became a hostage under the control of rioting inmates. 4 days later, they would strangle him to death and drop his body out of a window into the prison yard. Make it a habit. It is one of the best things you can do for your family, and it is a powerful gesture for yourself. And never doubt that a warrior has strength enough to love and courage enough to show it. Chapter 2. Stress, uncertainty, and the four F's. Forewarned is forearmed. A police officer gave me this great example of what I call the fog of uncertainty. I've been in 4 shootings, and while they all have left lasting memories, I often think about another incident in which I did not shoot. My partner and I got a call about a man running through the halls of one of our nicer hotels holding a revolver. The caller said that he seemed mentally out of it. There was a torrential downpour as we pulled into the hotel parking lot, so it took us a moment to grasp that the blurred, distorted image we saw through the windshield was the suspect, shirtless and barefoot, standing out in the downpour, his arms down at his side, his head angled upward. His hands were empty. We scrambled from the car and took cover behind our doors. I shouted for him to put his hands behind his head, but he just lowered his head slowly and laughed at us. Then the scene took on a surrealistic look as he moved his feet together and stretched his arms out to his sides in sort of a crucifix pose. "I got a gun in my pocket," he yelled over the rain. "I'm going for it. You'll have to shoot me." It was then that I knew that I would have to kill him when he reached for the weapon. I had pointed my revolver at a lot of people at that point in my career, and I'd shot at one. But this time, I just knew in my mind and soul that I was going to kill this guy. "Here I go," the guy yelled, reaching downward towards his pocket. I squeezed the trigger on my revolver at least halfway back. The guy laughed and raised his hand back out to his side. Then he yelled the threat again and began lowering his hand. I decided I'd wait until I saw his hand come out with the weapon, before I fired. I was so very ready. He plunged his hand into his pocket, laughing loudly, insanely. When he jerked it out, I could see the gun, and I began to complete the squeeze on my trigger, when my partner shouted, "It's not a gun. It looks like a bunch of matchbooks." The rest of the day, I felt horrible, anxious, shaky, as if I needed to run really hard or punch something. I was just so extraordinarily wired. My psychology 101 take on it is that I didn't get a release. I was absolutely ready, mentally, spiritually, and physically to kill him, but then it didn't happen. I thank God that I didn't have to do it. But not getting the release after being so ready, so full of fight, felt awful. The fog of uncertainty. "For if the trumpet give an uncertain sound, who shall prepare himself to the battle?" 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 8. There are many burdens that weigh upon the warrior, and one of the greatest is uncertainty. Remember that the universal phobia is interpersonal aggression. And for a warrior in combat, this toxic event can happen at any time. This can seem like an insane roller coaster, riding up to the brink of death and destruction and then back, up and back, over and over, knowing with absolute certainty that at any time you can go over the edge to personal death and destruction. The constant anticipation of being attacked can have a profoundly toxic effect, especially when this stress continues over months and years. For the police officer or soldier, there is the constant possibility that just around the next corner, there might appear an individual who will dedicate all the noxious, cunning, and destructive venom of the most deadly opponent on the face of the earth towards snuffing your life out and sending you home to your family in a box. Consider this experiment that one of my old psychology professors told me about, conducted on three groups of rats. For 7 straight days, the first group got random shocks through electrodes tied to their tails. They would just be standing around doing whatever rats do, licking their little rat parts, and bam, they would get zapped. The second group of rats got a warning first. As they went about doing rat things, a bell rang, and 10 seconds later they would get zapped. Later on, the bell rang again, and the rats would think, uh-oh, and they got zapped. The third time the bell rang, the rats chorused, uh-oh, and again they got zapped. For an entire week, at random intervals, bell, shock, bell, shock. The third batch of rats, the lucky rats, was the control group. They got the bell, but were never zapped. At the end of the week, just as the rats were giddy with excitement that their lousy duty was over, the scientists killed them and dissected their bodies to see if they had ulcers, a good indication of stress. The control group that received only the bell tone showed the least indication of stress, while the majority of rats in the group that received random zaps showed ulcers. The group that received the warning bell first had just a few more ulcers than the group that had not been shocked at all, thus demonstrating that what caused the ulcers was not the shock, but rather the absence of a warning of an impending shock. When you are warned that something might happen, you can more easily control the amount of stress you receive. However, if you spend your life in denial and then something happens, it hurts you, and it hurts you seriously. That is why the sheep are destroyed by combat. The sheepdog, who expects the wolf and is prepared for it, thrives in the combat environment. The fog of uncertainty will dissipate when you are mentally prepared and accept the fact that on any given day there are bad people in the world who are able and willing to hurt you. This does not mean that the sheepdog's job is easy. It simply means that he can exist in a realm that destroys the sheep. Even the sheepdog must learn to live with and manage stress. The bathtub model of stress. Stress applied to the individual is not necessarily harmful. It is only when the stress is prolonged or overwhelming, and the individual is not able to cope with it, that it becomes harmful physically and/or psychologically. Davis and Friedman, The Emotional Aftermath of Crime and Violence. The bathtub model of stress is a useful tool for understanding the long-term effects of stress. We use this to help West Point freshmen, the plebes, deal with the stress of their new environment, and believe me, they definitely need it. Think of your body as a bathtub, and stress is the water that pours in. Now, the drain can only release so much. So if water comes in so fast that the drain cannot handle it, the water begins to rise. If it rises too high, it overflows and damages the floor. If 5 gallons are suddenly added to the tub, you have got to get out from under the faucet for a couple of days to let the water, the stress, subside. You have to be able to control your stress throughout your entire life. Life is a paced marathon, not a sprint. Think of it as a 4-quarter game. If you are in good physical shape, your tub is a little larger and you can handle a little more water before you overflow. The best way to make your drain bigger so that you process stress out faster is to engage in appropriate management dynamics, specifically daily vigorous physical exercise. The stress hormones flooding through your body are made for fight or flight and cannot be ignored. They need to be used, and hard exercise is the best way to do it. When you get busy, however, it is often your workout program that is the first thing to go. Do not let this happen to you, because exercise is the very thing you need. A daily run, 45 minutes pumping weights, or a basketball game are the kind of things that can help burn off the stress hormones flooding through your body. Be sure to work out with positive quality people who can help you blow off steam. You do not get anything from your workout when you exercise with bitter, trash-talking, or quick-tempered people. Such individuals only add to your stress. The four F's. The natural man has only two primal passions, to get and to beget. Sir William Osler, Science and Immortality. Several of my professors have told me about one 1950s psychophysiology textbook that has a dry joke embedded in it. It says that the function of the midbrain can be thought of as the four F's, fight, flight, feeding, and reproduction. There is value in understanding that this is indeed what the midbrain, the puppy, does. I have already talked about fight or flight. You know that if you are under stress, there is a distinct possibility that you may respond with inappropriate levels of aggression, which is something you must guard against. You also know that one of the healthiest ways to deal with stress is to get out from under it. Now let us look at the remaining two realms of the midbrain, feeding and reproduction, functions that generally manifest themselves after combat. Some people lose their desire for food when overly stressed, but the more common response is to develop an enhanced appetite. The midbrain is a simple organism, and it can only do one thing at a time. When anxiety eats away at you, the puppy pokes his nose through the screen door, whining and whimpering. So you eat a big piece of chocolate cake, which is the same as giving him a bone to gnaw on for a while. While you overeat, the puppy stays busy, and you get a break from your anxiety. When you stop, however, he is back at the screen door, whining and whimpering, as once again your anxiety gnaws away at you. It is a vicious cycle, because not only are you not dealing with the cause of your stress, your attempt to placate it with food leads to obesity and the many health problems associated with it. This is why daily vigorous exercise is so vital. Pumping iron, running, and vigorous sports burns off the stress hormones that motivate you to eat. It also burns off a few calories, which makes the body healthier, or the tub a little larger, so that you can more easily handle the incoming stress. The better shape you are in, the more motivated you are to continue to burn off stress hormones in a healthy way, rather than trying to appease it with comfort food. Food has a powerful calming effect. I think that it may be virtually impossible to be in condition black and eat at the same time. When I train at National Hostage Negotiators conferences, I encourage them to use food as a calming tool with hostage takers. While a person is eating, he is usually in condition white or yellow, which can be one of the best times to make rational arguments. This can also be one of the best times for the SWAT team to roll the flashbang in the door. When the suspect is in condition red, his auditory exclusion and other stress responses we have discussed greatly limit the sensory overload caused by this device. Pick your time well, such as when he is eating, and there is a better chance that flashbang will stun the suspect, and no one will have to die that day. The fourth F, sex. Sex is ever to a soldier kind, the Odyssey. Some people lose their appetite for food in response to stress, but many have an enhanced craving to eat. In the same way, some individuals can lose their sex drive in response to great stress. But other people experience a tremendous sex drive, especially after a combat situation in which they were triumphant. Faced with death, destruction, and horror all around, there can be a powerful life-affirming drive towards sexuality. Frank Herbert, in his book Dune, referred to this as the fertility drive of the species, that profound drive shared by all creatures who are faced with death, the drive to seek immortality through progeny. Others believe that it may just be the drive of a male, having defeated another male in a mating battle, to claim his prize. Understand that if this should happen to you, it is perfectly normal. There is nothing wrong with you if it doesn't happen, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with you if it does. Once I had the pleasure of training a large group of FBI agents and their spouses at a conference in Reno. I told them about this common response and that it was perfectly normal, and there was a sudden roar as many of them turned to their spouses and said, "See, I'm okay. It's all right." That great pioneer in the field of warrior science, Bruce Siddle, tells about a state trooper that he had trained who was forced to kill someone in the line of duty. Bruce called him the next day to see how he was doing. Bruce says, "I heard about the shooting, and I wanted to be sure you're okay." The trooper said that he was doing fine. "As a matter of fact," he said, "I'm a little worried how fine I am, because last night my wife and I had the best sex we've had in months." I tell the law enforcement officers I train that there are not many perks that come with this job, so if you find one, relax and enjoy it. On the other hand, when I work with school resource officers, I have to give them a little warning. After a traumatic incident on or near the campus, there might be a tendency for the female to be drawn to an alpha male who can protect her, and there might be a tendency for the male to spread the genes around in the face of anxiety and sudden death. I tell the officers that forewarned is forearmed, and biology is not destiny. If we know that these things might happen, then we can avoid being blindsided by them and channel them through appropriate paths and appropriate sexual partners at appropriate times. Physiological stress responses in females. It is all right for a woman to be, above all, human. Anais Nin, Diary of Anais Nin. Before we leave the issue of sexuality in combat, let's look briefly at one other aspect. We know that it is common for junior high or high school female athletes to stress their bodies in training to the extent that they stop having their monthly periods. It is logical, therefore, that junior high or high school girls who witness the horror of their friends being gunned down may also experience a cessation of their periods. It is a normal response. Now, we know there is an ongoing level of sexual activity among high school and middle school students, and after a horrific incident, such as a Columbine or a Jonesboro, there may be an even greater level of sexual activity. How do you think the girls are going to react when they fail to have their periods? Stressed? Do you think it might stress those boys out, too? We think some of the extreme stress response, and perhaps even some of the suicides that occur in the first 2 months after these horrendous events, might be linked to this phenomenon. These young girls' lives are already stressful. That is, their tubs are already full. Just dealing with all that goes into being a teenager. So when they experience a traumatic event, and a few weeks later think they are pregnant, it can be just too much for some of them. This is a relatively easy problem to deal with. When we were working in the school after the Jonesboro massacre, I was first made aware of this possibility by my old battalion sergeant major, Jeff Sherman. He knew about it from his time as a drill sergeant in charge of a platoon of female recruits. After the incident, we advised the girls' physical education teachers to tell their girls' PE class that their periods might stop in response to what they had experienced. The girls should know that if it happens, it does not necessarily mean they are pregnant. That is all it took to short-stop the problem. Incidentally, our adult female warriors need to know that the same thing could happen to them as a result of a deadly force incident. As warriors, if we did not know this could happen, there would be no way for us to protect these little lambs from the aftershock stressors that can occur. A firefighter knows all about the many stages of fire, including the cleanup and toxic effects afterward. Likewise, it is important that warriors know all about interpersonal human aggression, because, sadly, it is many times more likely to kill or injure our children than fire. That is our job, and we must be masters of the realm. Chapter 3, PTSD. re-experiencing the event and fleeing from the puppy. Thane High of Oceanside can't stand the smell of meat on a barbecue. High was a Graves Registration Officer in Europe in World War II. He and his 8-man squad picked up more than 1,700 corpses from the front lines in France, Belgium, Germany, and Czechoslovakia. The worst things were the tank battles, he explains. If a tank was hit and burned, you had to wait until the tank cooled down, sometimes 2 or 3 days. We'd get the 5 names of the men who were in it from the tank commander. After the tank cooled down, we'd go in and open the hatches and try to get some kind of remains from the bodies. If we were lucky, we'd find an arm, a leg, or a foot, sometimes a skull. His voice quivers. To this day, I can hardly stand to have a barbecue because it reminds me of burnt flesh. David Weddle, Secrets at the Bottom of the Drawer. To begin our examination of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, let us draw straight from the DSM-4. This is truly the Bible of psychiatry and psychology, or the Big Book of Crazy, as one of my psychology professors used to put it. If you look at the extract from the DSM, you can find this DSM extract in the PDF. It looks a little complex at first, but it is really straightforward and simple. To have PTSD, you must have 2 from column A, 1 from column B, 3 from column C, and 2 from column D, kind of like a Chinese menu. First, look at paragraph A. To be at risk for PTSD, you must be exposed to a traumatic incident in which 2 things occur. First, the incident must be a life and death event that involves actual or threatened death or serious injury to you or to others. As a warrior, exposure to such events is not preventable. Your job is to move to the sound of the guns, to deliberately go into the realm of violence, death, and destruction. The second element that must occur is for you to respond to the exposure with intense fear, helplessness, or horror. When I'm training police officers, they usually have copies of my handouts, and I always tell them to underline these 4 words: intense fear, helplessness, or horror. A little bit of fear can manifest itself in condition red, and this can be a useful response. But intense fear, helplessness, and horror is what we have defined as condition black, and we know that this is not a desirable thing. As S.L.A. Marshall noted, fear in combat is ever-present, but it is uncontrolled fear that is the enemy. Now, you cannot do anything about the exposure to a life-threatening situation. As a warrior, it is your job to go into danger, but you can do something about how you respond to it. This is critical, because if you do not feel a sense of intense fear, helplessness, or horror, there is no PTSD. You create fear, helplessness, and horror by being a sheep. You prevent it by being a sheepdog, a warrior. If there is no sense of helplessness because your training has taught you what to do, there is no PTSD. If there is no horror because you have been inoculated against seeing blood, guts, and brains, there is no PTSD. If there is no intense fear, meaning your heart rate does not shoot up to 175 beats per minute, because you use your tactical breathing, there is no PTSD. Re-experiencing the event. The puppy comes for a visit. We must admit that what is closest to us is the very thing we know least about. Although it seems to be what we know best of all, it is just because the psyche is so close to us that psychology has been discovered so late. C.G. Jung, Modern Man in Search of a Soul. Next, look at paragraph B, re-experiencing the event. Think of it as when the puppy comes for a visit. Anyone can re-experience the event after a traumatic episode. Many police officers and soldiers, warriors who purposely go into the toxic realm of violence, have experienced this. It is important to emphasize here that just having the puppy come for a visit, re-experiencing the event, is not by itself PTSD. My co-writer, Lauren Christensen, served as a military policeman in Saigon, Vietnam, in 1969 and 1970, perhaps the most dangerous city in the world at that time. He had to contend with rocket attacks, snipers, terrorist bombings, anti-American riots, bar fights, racial violence, and a host of other deadly stressors. He said that after he returned home and bought a house in a quiet neighborhood, a large community of Vietnamese sprang up about a mile from where he lived. He never thought much of it. He drove by the housing projects every morning on his way to the police precinct. One morning, about 10 years to the day after he had returned from the war, he drove by the projects on his way to the firing range where he worked as an instructor. As he waited at a stoplight, he said a dozen Vietnamese children crossed the street in front of him. "Panic hit me like an overwhelming wave," he said. "I looked at those kids, especially the girls, who were wearing an Ao Dai, the traditional white tunic over black pants, a sight I saw every day in Vietnam, and my first thought was, I have to get more guns." Sweating profusely and breathing as if he had just run a mile, he turned his truck around and returned home to get two more firearms. He had the presence of mind to take a different route to the firing range, and eventually his heart rate, trembling hands, and profuse sweating went away. About 2 weeks later, he had a similar experience while shopping in a military surplus store for backpacking gear. When he bent over a large bin to rummage through a pile of used fatigue pants, he smelled the familiar odor of the material, and he again began to sweat heavily, breathe raggedly, and became nearly overpowered with a sense of unexplained panic. As before, it took Christensen several minutes to return to normal. He says it was not until he had two more episodes in the following weeks that he began to research the symptoms of PTSD. With a new understanding of what was happening to him, he was able to make peace with the memory and has never had such intense episodes since. Christensen was like every returning soldier from Vietnam in that he was not debriefed. One day he was in a war-torn environment, and the next day he was stepping off an airplane in Oakland, California. He got a steak dinner, a fresh uniform, and a discharge. 4 hours later, he was sitting in his parents' living room. Re-experiencing the event can be caused by extended periods of danger and stress, as happened with Christensen after his tour of duty in Vietnam. Or the puppy might come for a visit after a single significant traumatic event. Robert Speer, an Arkansas state trooper, who is now in command of their state SWAT team, tells about how he had to kill a gunman in a desperate and explosive gunfight at point-blank range. He had difficulty sleeping for a few nights, but otherwise he was fine. At least he thought so. Until one evening a week later, when he and his wife were watching his daughter at a swimming competition. "Maybe it was one of the starter's guns that set me off," he said. "All of a sudden, out of the blue, my heart started pounding. I began hyperventilating, and I was drenched with sweat." His reaction was so powerful that his wife thought he was having a heart attack. This was a classic example of a powerful post-combat response, commonly called a panic attack. Sometimes it is referred to as an anxiety attack, but that term is not appropriate. He was not feeling a little anxiety. The puppy inside his head was panicking. During his gunfight, his heart rate skyrocketed, and a neural network was established when the puppy blew a hole through the screen door. That neural pathway was still in place when a week later the unexpected sound of the starter's pistol at a swim meet caused the trooper's puppy to burst through the hole in the screen door, jump into his lap, pee, gnaw at his throat, and cry out, "Gunfight! Gunfight! Where's the gunfight? Where? Robert is fine today, a true warrior leader with a lifetime of successful combat experiences behind him. But at that time, he had two things working against him. First, no one warned him that he might have such a reaction. Second, no one taught him what to do should it happen. Untold hundreds of thousands of other people across the millennia have been through traumatic events and have later relived their experiences. They too have had two things working against them. No one warned them that they might re-experience the event, and no one taught them what to do should it happen. So, I'm warning you now that it might happen, and here is what you should do if it does happen. Again, do not think that everyone who gets in a deadly force encounter will get a visit from the puppy. In Dr. Dave Klinger's research of 113 SWAT team members who had shot and hit an adversary in real combat, approximately 40% of them re-experienced the event. If you are stress inoculated, know how to use the breathing techniques, and are properly trained in survival tactics, then you can reduce the possibility that it might happen. Still, even mature, world-class warrior leaders with a lifetime of experience under their belts, like Robert Speer in this case, and Randy Watt, who we will meet later in this chapter, can re-experience their traumatic event and have the puppy come for a visit. It is important that you understand that a visit from the puppy does not necessarily mean you have PTSD. Re-experiencing the incident can be a normal reaction to an abnormal event. You need to make peace with the memory and get on with your life. PTSD, as you will see later, occurs when you try to flee from the memory. The Grassy Meadow and the Widow of 50 Years. Memory, the Warder of the Brain. Shakespeare, Macbeth. Your brain has billions of neurons, like spaghetti noodles in a bowl. Everywhere these noodles touch, there is a neural connection, forming a vast three-dimensional neural network. For our purposes, let us create a two-dimensional model of your brain. Think of your mind as a vast meadow filled with waist-high grass. Every time you walk on it, you leave a path behind you. That path is your memory. If you walk up and down that path several times, you begin to beat a trail. That is learning and training. Thus, we can think of your brain as a vast meadow that is filled with trillions of paths and trails, some shallow, some deep. Now, imagine a lady who has been married to someone for 50 years. Every day of her married life, she got up with her husband. Every night, she went to bed with him. He is not just a path or a trail in her meadow. He is a valley that has been carved deeply across the decades. He is the dominant terrain feature in her meadow. Then, one day, he dies. It can take our widow of 50 years a long time to rewire her brain around this new reality. Although she will mourn her husband at the funeral, the grieving process will take far longer than just the funeral. For the first few days, she might begin to set a place for her husband at the table and then realize that he will not be coming to dinner, which devastates her all over again. For months after, she might see motion out of the corner of her eye, turn expecting to see him, and then remember that he will not be there. Slowly but surely, she will rewire her brain around the fact that her companion and lover of 50 years is gone. In general, the grieving process will probably take less time for other members of the family, because their paths are not as deep. There will always be an ache and a hollow spot in their hearts, but the actual neuronal adjustment to the new reality will be over in a comparatively shorter time. But our widow of 50 years needs more time. There are two rules by which she has to operate during this process, rules that we all intuitively understand. First, she must come to terms with the reality of his death. She cannot pretend he never lived. She cannot pretend he is not dead. She cannot refuse to ever talk about him again. She cannot refuse to let anyone mention him. She must accept the reality of what has happened. To think any other way would be pathological. Second, our widow of 50 years must separate the memory from the emotions. If she is still sobbing hysterically a year later every time someone mentions her husband, something is clearly wrong. It is normal and healthy for her to weep at first, but a year or two later, she will hopefully be able to bounce her grandchild on her knee and tell him a story about his grandpa without completely losing control. A tear might leak from her eye, but she will not lose control of her breathing and her speech. This is the end state of healthy grieving, to fully come to terms with the reality of what has happened and to separate the painful emotions from the memory. Now, imagine a disruptive force underneath your meadow, an earthquake that suddenly rips open a canyon that is as deep as the one formed by our widow's memory during her 50 years of marriage. This is what can happen when fear, helplessness, and horror are experienced during a life-and-death situation. I have likened this to a puppy ripping a hole through the screen door, but in extreme cases, it could be much more than that. When a canyon has been ripped into your meadow, you must operate by the same two rules as our widow. First, you cannot pretend that the incident did not happen. You cannot refuse to let anyone talk about it, and you cannot refuse to ever talk about it. That would be profoundly unhealthy. Second, after a year has passed, you should not still be weepy, angry, or emotional every time you are reminded of the event. Do not fool yourself into believing that it is okay to get angry, because that is the same as getting weepy. Both are uncontrolled manifestations of the puppy or the sympathetic nervous system. Likewise, fleeing from the memory is unhealthy, as it will only drive you down the path of PTSD. Your healthy, long-term survival requires that you do the same as our widow and make peace with the memory. Making peace with the memory. Macbeth, canst thou not minister to a mind diseased, pluck from the memory a rooted sorrow, raise out the written troubles of the brain, and with some sweet, oblivious antidote, cleanse the stuffed bosom of that perilous stuff which weighs upon the heart? Doctor, therein the patient must minister to himself. Shakespeare, Macbeth. Here is an example sent to me in an email from Colonel Randy Watt, Assistant Chief of Police for the Ogden, Utah Police Department. For years, he was the commander of their SWAT team, and he had many deadly force encounters during his decades of experience in law enforcement. He is also a Special Forces, Green Beret, Warrior, and the U.S. Army Reserves and National Guard, with an unprecedented amount of time on an A-team as a sergeant and officer. In 2002, this seasoned veteran warrior was sent to Afghanistan, where he saw considerable action and was subsequently nominated by U.S. Army Delta Force operators for a Silver Star for gallantry in combat. He explained in his email what happened to him when he got home and the puppy came for a visit. I thought I'd share an interesting experience with you. Yesterday was our semi-annual FATS, Firearms Training Simulator, shoot. This is a realistic video game-type training device that uses a large movie screen and high-quality sound. I went out to the simulator, and they had laid out six scenarios of varying degrees. You know the drill. The first three were standard law enforcement stuff, like buy, bust, bar fight, etc. No problems. The fourth one was an ambush on the police officer, me. The setting was a suspicious Jeep parked in a rural area with large rock piles and small trees surrounding the area. I immediately was struck by the thought that this location looked familiar. That is, it reminded him of Afghanistan. During the check of the vehicle, four suspects come up from behind the rock piles, two with long guns and two with pistols, and open fire. I reacted properly and engaged, moving to cover, etc. However, the physiological response was something I had never experienced before. My palms were instantly sweating. My chest was constricted. My breathing was ragged, and my pulse was racing. I was breathing rapidly and shallowly. The trainer evaluators didn't notice anything, but I sure did. I completed the next two, again standard law enforcement scenarios, and then asked to do the ambush one again. I wanted to see if I could desensitize my response to it. After all, it's not real, it's just a video. I couldn't desensitize. It evoked the very same physiological response, which had not dissipated in any way. I finished up and left, but it took 2 or 3 hours for the physical effects to subside. The adrenaline dump had not burned off. Then, last night, I had a very restless night. I had weird dreams all about combat situations, but with unrealistic and disconnected responses. I am one of those guys you talk about in terms of being macho. When I came home, I told everyone I was fine and that the war had no effect on me. I've been back about 3.5 months now, and I'm beginning to see that I've been lying to everyone, especially myself. 2 weeks after I came back to the police department, one of my friends came to me quietly and asked if I was all right. He said that he and some of my friends were worried about me, that I wasn't the same guy as before I had gone over. He said that I was quieter, less aggressive in nature, and not at all outspoken. Having been a serious extrovert all my life, I wasn't sure what he meant, so I asked my wife about it. She said they were right. Anyway, I told him that I was fine, just that I was readjusting to the change in environment. It appears to me now that the war and the activities we were involved in over there had more effect than I want to admit. I'm fine. I'm not crazy or anything. I'm just now realizing that time is going to be my best friend. This was my response. My brother, this is a classic example of a kind of sensitivity that is very common after an intense combat experience. We saw lots of examples after World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. Most commonly, we heard stories of GIs who hit the deck reflexively when they heard an unexpected loud noise, like a car suddenly backfiring. What happened with these GIs, and with you, is that the midbrain, or the unconscious mind, or the puppy inside, as I put it, has learned to bypass logical thought processes and establish conditioned reflexes, or sympathetic nervous system responses, instantly, without having to be told to do it. This can be a powerful survival mechanism in combat. For example, your unconscious mind hears the incoming artillery, and you hit the ground without having to spend time thinking about it, saving vital milliseconds in the process. It just takes time for this kind of conditioned reflex to decay. Using your breathing exercises and gaining conscious control over these sympathetic nervous system responses is like putting a leash on the puppy. But remember, to the puppy, and we really do have a puppy inside, that gunfight in that fat simulator was real. We have hit the level where our simulations can be real enough to fool the puppy, the unconscious mind, and that is pretty damn real. You can think of it as being like a kid who touches a hot stove. After being burned just one time by that stove, he will stay far away from it in the future, because the kid's puppy inside will immediately come on alert whenever he gets close to it. The way to deal with this is to spend a lot of time around the stove and learn how to remain calm in spite of the potential danger, which is exactly what most of us do. Sure, the stove can burn you, but it also can provide good food. In the same way the warrior can say, sure, combat can hurt you, but it can be the means by which I save lives and help to preserve my civilization. And that can be very rewarding. Here is another example that a lot of guys can understand. On a football team, a defensive lineman can come to associate the rising inflection of the opposing quarterback's voice with being hit by 300 pounds of offensive lineman. After a while, he can get pulled off sides by a tricky quarterback who goes hut, 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 but does not snap the ball. His puppy has been tricked. Trying to not think about it. To think that I am not going to think of you anymore is still thinking of you. Let me then try not to think that I am not going to think of you. Takuon, 17th century Japanese Zen Buddhist monk, writer, and poet. Take a look at paragraph C of our DSM extract. The puppy is coming for a visit, and since it scares the hell out of you, you try to not think about it. You might try to avoid all stimuli associated with the traumatic event, as well as any thoughts, feelings, or conversations associated with the trauma. Is this even possible? Can you really avoid a thought? Choose a topic and try not to think of it again for the rest of your life. It is impossible. This is what I wrote next in my answer to Randy Watt. How would a good coach deal with this problem of a lineman being pulled off sides by his past associations and that tricky quarterback? Well, in practice, he would probably put the defensive line through lots of plays, and in many plays, he would have the offensive quarterback try to pull the defensive line offsides. If a player had a particular problem, the coach might even put him through hours of drills designed to teach him to react to the snap of the ball and not to the quarterback's voice. In the same way, you need to go through that fat scenario and other scenarios as many times as you need to until you can remain calm. Then try it with paint bullet scenarios. The response that you have told me about is very common in law enforcement officers who have been in deadly force encounters. Many law enforcement trainers have told me about officers who were in gunfights and then later, when they were in simulators or paint bullet training scenarios, they had powerful sympathetic nervous system responses. Some of them went into condition red too soon, like you did. Others went straight into condition black in their first training simulation after combat and could not perform properly. These trainers have learned that they must ease these combat veterans back into the business, sometimes running the scenarios repeatedly until they feel calm and collected while shooting in a combat situation. You boys out in Utah understand this. It's called getting back on the horse. You instinctively knew to do this the first time when you went back through the scenario again. Now keep on doing it. A seasoned veteran is a very valuable commodity, to say the least. But that seasoning was expensive. Lives may have been lost in combat to buy that seasoning. We don't want those lost lives to have been in vain. We need that veteran warrior in coming battles. So it is a small expense to be sure that they have been properly eased back into combat. We'll put them back on the horse, but it will be a horse we know they can master, not one that will just buck them off again and reinforce the negative associations. For World War II vets who jumped when the car exhaust went off, it just took time for the reflexes to decay. Most of them laughed it off and went on with life. Some of them, unfortunately, did not understand what was happening, and they were deeply concerned about it. They thought they were losing their mind, and nothing scares us more than that. So they tried all kinds of things to prevent the response from happening, like avoiding situations with loud noises, or trying not to think about or talk about their combat experiences, when what they really needed to do was to spend so much time around the stimulus, the noise, without the bad stuff, death and injury, that it no longer excited the puppy. Remember, just having the puppy come for visit is not PTSD. According to the DSM, the Bible of Psychiatry and Psychology, PTSD happens when, one, you feel fear, helplessness, or horror, that is, have a powerful sympathetic nervous system response in a life-and-death situation, and, two, you persistently re-experience the event, that is, the puppy keeps coming for a visit, in flashbacks, dreams, and/or sympathetic nervous system arousal in response to events or cues that symbolize or resemble an aspect of the traumatic event. And here is where you start moving down the wrong path. Number three, you persistently avoid stimuli associated with the trauma, including efforts to avoid thoughts, feelings, or conversations associated with the trauma, and/or efforts to avoid activities, places, or people that arouse recollections of the trauma. And number four, the disturbance lasts for at least a month, and it causes clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. Number three is the important part. We can't avoid going in harm's way. And there is always a chance that we will get highly excited when people are fighting and dying. This may be especially true when you're wounded, which may cause the puppy to come for a visit. But we can prevent the persistent avoidance of things that bring the puppy for a visit. And that means plenty of range time, simulator time, and paint bullet force on force scenarios every chance you get, combined with breathing the leash until the puppy gets under control. Preventing fear, helplessness, and horror through previous training is step one in preventing the potential for a PTSD response. In your case, you have done that about as well as any human being could do. But still, there is a leftover mental residue of combat that can bring the puppy for a visit, that is, unwanted sympathetic nervous system responses, in even the most well-prepared warrior. It is worth repeating. When this happens, the key is to focus on preventing number three. Spending a lifetime trying to avoid stimuli, thoughts, feelings, conversations, activities, people, or places that make the puppy come for a visit can literally make you crazy. The World War II vets did not have force-on-force paint bullet scenarios and simulators to go back to. So for some, their combat responses slowly decayed. Others never made friends with the memory of the puppy, and they lived in fear of their responses for a lifetime. But you do have that opportunity to engage in realistic training, and you should. As to becoming more introverted and other personality changes, note number four, you do not have a full-blown case of PTSD unless it lasts for at least a month and you have significant impairment of some important part of your life. In your case, it may be that some of the personality changes will go away with time. However, it is normal and healthy for an extroverted person to grow more introverted as they grow older. We get more comfortable with ourselves. Or for an introverted person to get more extroverted, we get more comfortable with others. If you are troubled by what is happening and are not satisfied with your progress, there is absolutely no shame in going to a licensed counselor who specializes in this area and talking it over with him. There are other tools which can help. For example, a lot of combat vets in law enforcement and military have been helped by EMDR, which I will discuss later. For now, you've hit it right on the head. Time is your best friend. Randy understood all of this, and this was his wise response. As a result of what happened last week, I've also begun a personal therapy program. I'm starting to train my SWAT guys again, including paint bullet force-on-force engagements and simulators. To talk about my experiences, that seems to really help. And I'm spending a couple of days per week on the range, going through the mechanics of shooting. But now I'm going to add some visualization aspects. I'll keep you apprised of how things are going. I'm not worried or concerned about what's happening to me. Your lectures from the past prepared me well. I just thought you might enjoy seeing your doctrine validated. Later in this audiobook, we will talk more about how you can de-link the memory from the emotions and make peace with the memory, which are positive and healthy responses to the re-experiencing phenomenon. For now, I want to hold up Randy Watt as a model for others. First, he educated and trained himself ahead of time, so that he had a good idea of what was happening to him. He's a true warrior of the highest caliber, and he has nothing to prove to anyone in the law enforcement or military worlds. But even with all of his experience and credentials, he was still affected by his combat experiences. Warrior that he is, when he saw what was happening to him, he took immediate corrective action. No denial, no shame, just action. Second, by sharing this experience with others, he was able to help with his own healing while also using his experience to guide others down the warrior path. Again, no guilt trip, no denial, no pity party, just decisive action to help himself and others. Rejecting the gift that keeps on giving. But after the fires and the wrath, but after searching in pain, his mercy opens us a path to live with ourselves again. Rudyard Kipling, The Choice. Now look at items 4, 5, and 6 under paragraph C in our PTSD extract from the DSM. Not only are you impacted by post-traumatic stress disorder, but your spouse and kids are also affected as you begin to lose interest in the things you used to enjoy. In an effort to